bankruptcy bonuses, losing executives, winning new deals, the unfair airfare problem, and dollar dumb, failing financial literacy.
From your wallet to Wall Street, helping you make better decisions about your money. Lock it in. This is E-Trade Financial Weekend.
Happy weekend, everybody, and happy Mother's Day. From our studios in Chicago, I'm Tom Hudson. Jonathan Honig, my usual co-pilot, has the weekend off. No fear, though. The seat is filled and warm today. John Bentz, president of the Chicago-based AppleTree Investments Group, along with us. John, happy weekend to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. Listen, quite a week we've had here. The big rise on Wednesday, notwithstanding, all three major indices in the week in the red.
Absolutely true. I think it was a kind of a false positive that we had.
Yeah, sure.
And I think the WorldCom situation, the Cisco situation, when they actually looked at those numbers that they got, people said, hey, I don't see really a recovery here.
Well, when we're talking about Cisco, certainly. I mean, the company came out with its fiscal third quarter numbers. The story is well known. It beat the street and didn't really provide very enthusiastic guidance for the fourth quarter, but that didn't matter on Wednesday. Now, come market action Thursday and Friday, we saw a little bit of give back each day. And then you mentioned WorldCom. Telecom is back in the dog shed again with this junk status for its bonds.
It certainly is. Moody's and S&P downgraded it, and anything below BA1 or double B plus on the S&P side, anything below that, and you got junk status. And that's where they're at right now. They've got $30 billion in debt. They need to raise another $2 billion. And when they go out to do that, it's going to be a heck of a lot more expensive than it was 2 days ago.
Yeah, WorldCom hitting lifetime lows this past week on this debt downgrade. Still to come here on this weekend show, John, we're going to talk about the future of the airline industry. You do a lot of traveling for work, I know.
Sure.
Have you noticed a difference in kind of how airfares are parceled out since September 11th at all?
It's weird. I mean, I don't want to plan a trip 6 months in advance to get a good fare. And if you don't do that, it's a little crazy.
You can really pay the price for it. We're going to be
really
speaking with one guy that has some ideas about how to fix the airline industry and the airfares especially. Also talking about why high school kids are in the dark when it comes to finance. It's amazing what this new study has found about, quite frankly, how dollar dumb kids are when they get their high school diploma. We'll also continue our series called Financing and Education on Friday over at the website mediacenter.etrade.com. We talked about some of the ways to take advantage of financial aid and scholarships for an undergraduate degree. Today, we're going to focus on graduate school, how to find some of that money and help pay for that graduate degree program as well. It's all to come here on the Weekend Edition. You know, John, one of the cruel ironies of business, when a company declares bankruptcy, it's usually the rank-and-file employees that get all those pink slips, get fired, no longer have health care coverage, no longer have retirement benefits. Meantime, some of the top-level executives actually can reap benefits, sometimes in the several thousand, even $1 million range or so, getting paid retention bonuses to stick around. It's happened with at least a couple of big bankruptcies recently. Enron and Kmart both had these retention bonuses. Harvey Teppner is managing director of Loeb Partners. That's a group that advises companies trying to recover from bankruptcy. He joins us now. Harvey, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, generally speaking, what's the theory behind these corporate retention bonuses? Why do companies give them out when they're in bankruptcy?
They're designed as estate preservation devices. The whole point of a retention bonus is to try and retain management who will help you achieve reorganization objectives and try and do so in as orderly a manner and efficient a manner as possible.
But aren't these the same executives that ran the company into bankruptcy in the first place?
Well, the series of answers are probably going to be a series of it depends, because it's very situation specific. Companies that go into Chapter 11 sometimes do so for a series of reasons, almost always involving some element of management mistake or misstep. But often the same people get you into bankruptcy have the talent at various levels to get you out of it. They have a lot of knowledge. They can help for an orderly transition to either a new balance sheet structure, a new operational structure, a new ownership or new management structure. And when all the things are going bad at the same time, or the appearance is going bad, you don't want to have experienced and sometimes very capable management, despite the Chapter 11 filing, run for the hills and leave the business without any management or personnel with any knowledge or history and capable of reorganizing itself.
Harvey, this is John Bentz. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. It seems like to me it comes down to leverage and how much leverage the person, the employee, has against the company and how important their job is, kind of like a human capital Darwinism. But the thing that I have the problem with is they give a retention bonus and then 2 weeks later they fire you.
If you're trying to structure a proper retention program, the key is to figure out who requires it, who, as a candidate, do you need to keep or you'd otherwise have to recruit from the outside to help you get through a Chapter 11, and what the likely outcomes are in a Chapter 11? For example, if a company files for Chapter 11 and as part of the Chapter 11 plan is trying to sell itself in short order to a third company or a new buyer, then retention bonuses and retention programs become less compelling, and all you need is people to stick around for an orderly transition period that may be 60 to 180 days long. If you're trying to restructure a company and the people responsible for the trouble are still in charge of management, then you have to be very careful if you're not rewarding the wrong people and giving the wrong people incentives to continue running the organization the way they did prior to the Chapter 11 filing.
Harvey, if the idea behind retention bonuses in bankruptcy really is to limit brain drain, limit those folks that are crucial to picking this company back up out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy, how effective has it been in the past?
I think it depends. It really depends upon what situation the business is in. In certain cases, it could be very effective. In other cases, it could be a complete waste of money. It really depends upon the situation the business is in. For example, you mentioned Kmart.
Mm-hmm.
Kmart is clearly a company capable of reorganizing and being reorganized. It has got significant critical mass. It has some real balance sheet issues. I understand it has some real operational issues. But there should be incentives for the management team, and should be the right management team, to stick around and work hard to achieve reorganization scenarios that will give the greatest return to the creditors as possible.
Harvey, in a Chapter 11 situation, if the company is in Chapter and a judge is making a lot of the important decisions or some judicial body, are they approving the retention bonuses?
Yes, retention bonuses are normally developed by management, and Chapter 11, the management of the company is called the debtor, proposed to the court subject to a hearing and people to discuss it and give their motions in favor or opposed to it, and finally for a judge to rule on it.
You know, one of the many complaints against those retention bonuses we hear from shareholders whose value has evaporated in some cases.
Absolutely.
If they're still holding on to shares of Kmart, for instance, at a dollar, Enron less than a dollar, but also from vendors who are waiting to get paid. And Harvey, in some cases, those folks that are owed money from the bankrupt company are getting maybe 30 cents in the dollar for the contracts that were signed in good faith months before they ever went into Chapter 11. So I guess the question comes down to really, what are the priorities then?
Well, the answer is, where are you at the time of the Chapter 11 filing? The nice thing from the perspective of a company is that Chapter 11 gives you a blank slate to try and deal with all your issues at one point in time, starting at a point in time. If you sign a contract many months earlier, many years earlier, the contract is subject to being assumed or rejected or modified through a variety of discussions or a court decision. In terms of evaluating the management personnel that you need at the time of the Chapter 11 filing, which is probably one of the most important duties of a board at that time, is do we need this person or that person? Mm-hmm. What is that person's next best opportunity to go somewhere else? And what compensation program do we need, if any, to reward that person to stick around and let us get through a Chapter 11 process?
Harvey, what about public relations? What do these companies do when they have some of this bad press?
I'm not sure I understand the question. In terms of retention programs?
No, I mean, if there's some bad press because of some of the retention programs they have and some of the disgruntled shareholders, how do they handle this on a public relations basis?
I'm not sure there's any proper public relations spin you can put to the appropriateness of a retention program for a company that's facing Chapter 11 and dealing with shareholders and creditors who have an expectation of incurring some to a huge loss. I don't think there's any proper spin. The analogy I think of is the members of the House of Congress or Senate who every now and then are asked to review their own compensation and see if it's appropriate.
Nice.
And it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't approach.
Harvey, listen, the firm you work for, you advise companies trying to recover from bankruptcy. Have you sat down with Enron's or Kmart's, first of all?
No, we have not sat down with Enron's and Kmart's, and I need a clarification. We advise companies and creditors.
Okay. If you were able to speak with Enron and or Kmart, what would you tell them about the retention bonuses? Do you think those retention bonuses, the way they played out, were fair to the companies, the shareholders, and the employees?
I'm not going to offer you a specific comment on Kmart or Enron and the appropriateness or inappropriateness of their bonuses. I don't think that would be a fair thing to do.
But overall, certainly you think retention bonuses are something that do provide for future successes for some of these very troubled companies, I imagine.
They are designed to provide for future success or for achieving the highest recoveries available. and they can be very, very useful things if the right number of personnel are included at the right dollar amounts. And they can also be subject to abuse, and it needs to be very carefully designed and implemented.
And where does the money finally come from for these retention bonuses from a company that is obviously having problems?
The money comes from the company itself in terms of its ability to generate cash flow. It may come from, if the company is being sold, it may come from the sale of the company or the sale of divisions, or it may come from a liquidation and of the company's assets. But it also, there may be certain limiting factors that retention bonuses may only get paid upon certain criteria that are deemed to be successful. You can do a whole series of programs that give better bonuses and better incentives for better forms of recovery and better outcomes.
It may be performance-based at that. Harvey, thanks so much for spending some time this weekend with us.
You're very welcome.
Harvey Teppner is Managing Director of Loeb Partners, a group that advises companies trying to recover from bankruptcy and creditors. All right, we know this week that we've learned superheroes can mean big bucks on Wall Street.
Yes.
The huge opening last weekend of Superman, of course, helping Marvel Comics come back from the dead. Spider-Man, of course, coming back from the dead. Marvel Comics went bankrupt a couple of years ago, John, and their stock on its way back up. And we've seen a nice recovery in shares of Marvel, and already a Spidey sequel, of course, has been talked about.
I think two of them.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, look, you got to cash when the cash is good, right?
And they signed up Toby for both of them, I think.
Well, it certainly has played out successful at the box office thus far for Spider-Man. We think, though, that this sort of financial superhero needs to be put in play, perhaps, for Marvel Comics.
Sure.
And, of course, kind of putting the cart in front of the horse, you have to come up with a movie trailer before you actually come up with the movie. You want to entice the audience.
I understand about enticement.
This is exactly what we've done here.
In a world where companies rise and fall based on a rumor from Wall Street,
the CEO is retiring.
One man stands alone.
Look out, Green Arrow! It's a sell-off!
Not if my consumer confidence arrow has any say in the matter.
The Green Arrow, bit by the investing bug in the late 90s, is sworn to protect truth, justice, and his portfolio.
One sell rating from me, and the Green Arrow will be so busy protecting investors, he'll never notice I'm backing the board with Yes Men!
His friend's fallen. The Green Arrow fights alone.
This one's for you, Corporal Governance. You didn't die in vain.
This summer, there's gonna be some green on the screen. The Green Arrow.
Must get stuck! Moving upward! Yeah!
This film not yet rated by analysts.
Wow.
Can you imagine what Harvey Pitt and Alan Greenspan would have to say about their new super action hero, Green Arrow? Still to come on this weekend edition, stick around. We'll talk about unfair airfares and later on, the economics of education.
Take your business beyond the PC with EveryPath. Your business everywhere. EveryPath is helping companies operate in real time, offering complete mobile solutions. Access your company email, enterprise applications, intranets, and personal information managers anytime, anywhere. EveryPath mobile solutions can generate real ROI by reducing costs and improving productivity. Want to learn more about the benefits of mobility and how we can help your company? Call us at 800-2-EveryPath. That's 800-238-3797 or visit us at EveryPath.com. EveryPath, your business everywhere.
You made the right choice, Jennifer.
Yeah?
I'll give you everything you want.
Everything?
I'll give you things you...
Dylan? Dylan?
Jennifer, I can buy you a car like that.
Jennifer, come back!
What?
Come back!
Introducing the high-performance Lexus IS. With chronograph-style instrumentation inside its race-inspired cockpit. Drilled aluminum foot pedals and Formula One-style shifting so you never have to take your hands off the wheel to shift gears. The IS even offers perforated Exane trim seating so the driver doesn't slide during hard cornering. Under the hood, the 3-liter engine has an innovative tuned induction system to maximize torque while VVT-i optimizes power.
Dylan!
The Lexus IS. Totally unexpected. Test drive one at your Lexus dealer or visit Lexus.com.
Today's Wall Street Journal helps you succeed in more ways than ever. Subscribe now for just 38 cents a day. The Journal features all the important business news you need, and when it's time to focus on the business of life, there's the Personal Journal section. Get 8 weeks of the Journal for just 38 cents a day. This limited time offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S. only. Call 800-782-9500. That's 800-782-9500 for the Wall Street Journal.
The new E-Trade Financial here with some investment terms you might find helpful. Ever consider dollar cost averaging? Your portfolio might rest easier.
These days, it makes sense to think long and hard before making key financial decisions. That's where the new E-Trade Financial comes in. We've assembled the comprehensive tools and services you need to build a solid financial plan, bank, borrow, get advice, and most of all, results. Like the idea of working with people who can help you make smart financial decisions? We should put our heads together.
Dollar cost averaging is an investment strategy where you buy the same stock or mutual fund in set amounts at regular intervals. Since you're buying gradually over a long period of time, you're able to buy more shares during downturns, fewer during upturns. The net, dollar cost averaging may help reduce price per share for investors.
One thing's certain, E-Trade Financial has more of what you need to stay ahead in today's economy. So visit eTrade.com today or call 1-800-ETRADE-1.
Welcome back to E-Trade Financial Weekend with WebFN News anchor Tom Hudson and John Vince.
It's time for Investing with Ozzy.
Sharon, the dog is f***ing on the f***ing Wall Street Journal. How am I supposed to look at my f***ing stocks if the dog is f***ing on the f***ing journal, Sharon?
You know what a franchise Ozzy's got going now.
He just signed a $3 million book deal. I think they want two more years coming back with the Osbournes.
I think he's going to start doing a column in Barron's too over the weekend, believe it or not.
And I think Dan Quayle likes him. Well, better than Murphy Brown.
Better than Murphy Brown, believe it or not. Ozzy Osbourne. Viacom stock, by the way. Have to bring it down to equities ultimately. Group behind Ozzy Osbourne and MTV up by about 6.5% this year. Let's talk about the difficulties in the airline industry now. They began long before September 11th, and really despite all the urgency, John, that the carriers have had over the past several months trying to get passengers back in the planes, the airlines haven't simplified the airfares and all those confusing rules that go along with the tickets. Now, Joe Brancatelli is a business journalist and a former executive director of Frequent Flyer magazine. He also runs a website called JoeSentMe.com, and Joe joins us now here at E-Trade Financial Weekend. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks a lot.
Hi, Joe.
Let's begin, first of all, with what do you see as the biggest problem with these airfares? The confusing nature of them, the confining rules, where does it begin?
All of those, and frankly, the absolute adamant of the major airlines in this country to realize that there is a better and simpler way. You know, gentlemen, Southwest Airlines has made money for 30 years in a row. Count it up. That's 120 quarters in a row.
In fact, one of the very few airlines, if not the only major carrier, that still made money despite the huge slowdown after September 11th.
That's correct. The other one in the United States is JetBlue, which is only 2 years old and is essentially a Southwest clone. Now, these two carriers, and a carrier called WestJet in Canada, offer simple, rational pricing. Not always the cheapest price, but simple and rational and one way. These guys make money. They make money all the time. The other six major airlines say, well, we're not going to do that. And the reaction to that has been $11 billion in losses in the last five quarters. These are folks who just don't get it.
Joe, this is John Bentz. How are you?
Hello, John. How are you?
When will they get it? Are they just too big to maneuver and they have these sophisticated yield management programs and the computer software?
No, they're too stupid. I have to say this. You know, after years of covering these guys, this is the only industry that refuses to listen to the market when the market talks. They think it's about them as opposed to them providing a service to the market. They've turned the whole capitalist system upside down. They say, well, we've created this product and you better buy it. Well, and of course, the market says no.
Well, they certainly do have a monopoly on it.
Well, they have a monopoly on it, but people still do have choices. They could stay home, which is what business travelers have certainly done in record numbers since 9/11, but were doing before then.
There's got to be equilibrium from the supply and the demand side, though. They have to recognize this, don't they?
You would think they would. I mean, this is part of the problem. I actually gave a speech in the last few weeks at a college campus talking to young business journalists, trying to explain the difficulty of covering a market where the industry itself has gone berserk. Okay, this is an industry that refuses to look at the fundamentals. It doesn't even make the right technical moves. U.S. Airways announced on Friday they might have to go bankrupt.
Right.
This is an airline that didn't hedge their fuel costs, literally did not hedge their fuel costs when fuel kept running up and they got hit with hundreds of millions of dollars of extra cost.
Outside of airfares, though, Joe, isn't that part of the problem that the airlines have been wrestling with, just the high fixed costs that they have to deal with, high cost of labor, high cost of maintenance for these airplanes, high cost of jet fuel? It goes beyond just very complicated airfare rules, doesn't it?
This is a high fixed cost industry. There's no question about it. This is also a low margin industry, which leads you again back to the Southwest model, which says fly them cheap, fly them often, fly them simply. And the model works. I have to say, I've covered many industries in my life. I've never seen a business where one competitor makes money for 120 consecutive quarters, the rest of the industry is in boom and bust cycle, and now more bust than boom, and they continue to ignore the one competitor that makes money.
Well, covering this industry, Joe, why do you think that is? Why isn't American Airlines, United Airlines, U.S. West, or U.S. Airlines, Northwest Airlines?
They're all the same, whatever
listening.
Name you say. The problem really is lack of quality management. I mean, this is an industry, in fairness to it, that is really less than a generation away from cost-plus regulation. So this is not an industry that is blessed with a lot of brilliant managers. You can't name a manager that's come out of the airline industry and is brilliant on his own case or has gone on to somewhere else after cutting his teeth on airlines. We have no Jack Welch's in this business. The last guy to leave the airline business went on to run Burger King.
Joe, some of the customer service things that the airlines have done in the last maybe year or two has extended the seats so people have more leg room. I know American does it, I think, on all the coach class, and I think United does maybe on the first 10 or 12 rows,
correct,
depending on your mileage. But then there's talk of maybe, geez, we're not selling these seats, and you know we could add some more seats and possibly add some more revenue. Do you see that happening, or are they just going to slap against the customer in the face again?
I could see that happening in an industry that's so backward, but why would you add seats when you can't make money on the product you have now?
Right, sure.
I mean, that's the weird thing. Only American has really gone with this initiative that's added more seats. It's been very difficult to quantify an advantage for them, to be honest. But the problem has been it's been very difficult to figure out the economics of this business, certainly since 9/11 and even before that. But it really does come back to how they price the product, because the few carriers that do make money and make money consistently have shown that if you simplify the fares and in many cases lower at least what we would consider the retail price, not the actual selling price, you will increase revenue if you lower the fares. I know that sometimes that sounds counterintuitive, but that has been the proof of the Southwests and the JetBlues and the WestJet in Canada.
And I think most of the customers, getting back to the legroom issue, they like that, and they don't want to see, you know, maybe they're willing to pay an extra $5-$10, but they really like that customer service and, hey, I've got more room and I'm not a cattle in this cattle car here.
Well, that's part of the issue as well. The service levels at all levels of the airline industry have declined dramatically. Now, we like to say the customer is always right. The customer, as we know, is not always right, and sometimes they do ask too much of the airline industry. But in fairness, this is an industry that, much like the car industry in the 70s, where you could never get anyone to buy a car without a rebate, has convinced people that any price you charge them, someone else is paying less, so you must be getting ripped off.
Yeah.
This
and they're
is
upset.
Not a brilliant pricing or marketing strategy.
Except when you get to the Southwest Airlines and those kind of one or very simplified airfare structure. And I guess let's get down to some ways to fix this here. I mean, does it just get down to offering four different fares? You've got a first class, you've got a business class, you've got a coach, and you've got some other fare in there. Is that one way to fix this, Joe?
Well, where you've leapt on is, in fact, a column I put up at joesentme.com yesterday about a brief experiment American Airlines tried in 92 when they just initiated four fares. It got blown away, in a fit of pique. I don't think four fares would do it today, but six or seven fares would be rational in this market. Because you do the one key problem with airlines is that the business traveler and the leisure traveler not necessarily have different perceptions of what the seat should cost, but they have different uses for the seat. The business traveler, obviously more time sensitive. The leisure traveler, more flexible. You can, as Southwest and JetBlue do, admit to the market that, yes, in some cases, I will sell you a cheaper seat if you stay on a Saturday or if you fly on an off time. But the mainline carriers in this country have taken it to such an extreme that between New York and Los Angeles, which is our most busiest and also our most important route, there's something like 250 fares in the market.
You've certainly seen some of the problem, a lot of the problems in the airline industry reflected in the stock price of a lot of these companies. Do you own any shares in publicly traded airlines, Joe?
No, I do not, because I cover them, and I'm an old school kind of guy. I don't want ever the impression to be that I invest. Do I think the airlines are a good investment? No, I don't.
It's a good sector you picked to cover.
I cover a sector that needs covering. This is an industry that's kind of bizarre. You know, I mean, we do have a Krispy Kreme in this industry, though.
Joe,
that's
Joe,
JetBlue.
We got to run real quick though. Chicken or lasagna at 40,000 feet?
Neither. A bottle of water.
Fair enough. Joe Bracatelli, a business journalist and former executive director of Frequent Flyer magazine.
Tom, I don't know about you, but when I think about white-collar crime, I usually think about things like insider trading, insurance fraud, embezzlement.
Yeah.
But apparently these crimes of the past don't hold a candle to the white-collar crime currently in vogue, and that is identity theft. Hmm. Kate Bonner at the E-Trade Financial Center in New York has more.
Identity theft has become one of the fastest growing crimes in the United States. Last week, U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft noted that identity theft victimized between 500,000 and 700,000 people each year. Brian Murnahan in California State Office of Privacy Protection puts it quite succinctly.
Most people would tell you that it's a crime with very little penalty and relatively easy to do and hard to catch.
I asked Murnahan, what's the easiest way to steal a person's identity?
Those pre-approved credit card offers that you receive, they'll take one of those things that you've discarded and didn't tear up. They'll actually just change your address and your phone number and submit it for you. And they'll change it to their address and their phone number so they get your credit card.
So the million-dollar question, how are these criminals punished? Sadly, it's often barely more than a slap on the wrist. According to data collected by Syracuse University, the median term for those sent to prison in 2001 was 13 months for Secret Service cases and 7 months for FBI cases. About a third of those convicted did no prison time at all. So what can you do to protect yourself? Murnahan has the following suggestions.
First thing you should do is file a police report. You're a victim of a financial crime. Second thing would be to contact the financial reporting agencies, credit bureaus. You'd want to contact them, put a credit alert on, and that way anybody that applies for credit in your name, the person that's receiving the credit report will be able to take a look and say that you dispute any and all credit applications, and you want to be notified ahead of time. So that's real important. And then finally, the third main thing that you want to do is contact all of your current creditors and make sure that you're up to date and on everything that they have and that they all know that you're a victim of identity theft.
Also, you should be on the lookout for fake bank correspondence and tax forms. This is how it works. You, the unsuspecting individual, receives a phony IRS form stating that a bank is updating its records. You are then urged to fax the completed form to what you think is your bank. The scam uses several forms that are similar to real IRS forms, but have been altered to seek key personal information. The real forms can be viewed at www.irs.gov, and copies of some of the fake forms can be seen at www.occ.treas.gov. For E-Trade Financial, I'm Kate Bonner in New York.
Still to come on the weekend edition, finding financing for grad school, and later on, failing financial literacy.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to E-Trade Financial Weekend with WebFN News anchor Tom Hudson and John Vince.
Time now for another bad business decision. Consumer Reports, the magazine that uncovers bad products, has released a bad product of its own. A glove compartment organizer sent as an incentive to subscribers contains a flashlight that overheats and a tire gauge that gives inaccurate readings. Bad business decision. Readers can exchange the faulty gift for two Consumer Reports books, which also give inaccurate tire readings.
How ironic is that?
That's nice.
Consumer Reports, the group that goes after bad products, issue some bad products themselves.
That's nice.
Listen, bad business decision or not here. Listen, one decision that may be good for business, for the future of your business, is education. We're going to continue our series now, John, called Financing and Education. Friday, over at the website at mediacenter.etrade.com, we talked about some of the ways to take advantage of financial aid and scholarships for an undergraduate college degree. Today, focusing in on graduate school, how to find some money to pay for that. Now, many American workers are facing corporate downsizing, even possible layoffs, and have decided to go back to school to continue their education. Many are pursuing their master's degrees in hopes of returning to the workforce smarter and hopefully financially stronger. E-Trade Financial's Cheryl Cassoni finds out how those workers are paying for the cost of a higher education.
Higher education, it can be a costly ride. A recent study by the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education found that college has become less affordable for most Americans. Tuition has climbed more than twice the inflation rate over the last decade. Lynn, a graduate student at University of Texas in Austin, looked at different amounts of money and their interest rates to pay for her master's degree in English.
I tried to go with those that would be the minimal amount that I needed to survive so that I would be in less debt when I graduate.
Carrie, a student at the University of California, Berkeley, is pursuing another degree in education, has a fellowship, a scholarship, and a work-study program to help her finance her goals, but she's had to make sacrifices in other areas.
I'm actually living very adequately right now. I don't really feel the strain, but on the other hand, I don't have a car, and I don't, you know, I bike everywhere.
That minimal lifestyle will pay off for Carrie with job security. If she decides to work in public education, schools need to hire 2.2 million teachers over the next decade. The financial reward is questionable, though. First-year teachers earn an average of $35,000 a year. Nurses are also in demand. Nurse practitioners with master's degrees earn about $63,000 per year versus those without master's who earn $46,000. Norton Grubb, a professor of education at UC Berkeley, studied the effects a master's degree has on potential salaries. He says it's all about which field you choose.
Computer-related fields, math-related fields, science-related fields, and certainly the master's in business administration will have much greater returns than master's in social work or social welfare or master's in education or master's in library science.
In San Francisco, I'm Cheryl Cassoni, E-Trade Financial.
John, education really is, let's face it, an investment in one's future.
Absolutely.
I mean, you have to put some money at risk now, either be it your own money or you're going in debt to pay for graduate school at some level in the promise or hopes of a future payoff in the form of normally a higher salary. Now, I know you went to grad school, got a master's of business administration. Tell us about your experiences about trying to pay for school.
Well, first of all, I think you have to look at why you're going. And like just like you said, there's an economic benefit. There's also a benefit for your network, the people that you went to school with, mm-hmm. and that experience and the kind of the feelers that you bring out after that, as well as obviously putting it on your resume, but you're also there to learn.
Sure.
And hopefully you can kind of bring in and soak in some of that knowledge that's going through the academic walls. How I financed my business school was basically four ways. My own money, mm-hmm. My savings, and I was going to school when I was working, so it was my own savings. I borrowed money from my family. I had student loans, and also for a short stint, the company that I worked for prior to downsizing the entire segment that I was in,
sure.
That particular department paid for a part of it as well. So it was four different ways that I had to go.
And I know despite that investment, you're still here doing the weekend show. So it hasn't paid dividends quite yet, right, John?
Yeah. I get a lot of attaboys on my back, though.
I'm sure you do. Listen, we're going to be continuing our series, Financing and Education, on the Monday show at the website, mediacenter.etrade.com. Still to come in the weekend edition, an Investor Minute with newly listed companies.
Welcome back to E-Trade Financial Weekend with WebFN News anchor Tom Hudson and John Vince.
It's time for more investing with Ozzy.
Stocks, Sharon. I'm the prince of f***ing darkness. I don't pick f***ing stocks, Sharon. Oh, bloody hell.
Ozzy Osbourne stock picker. Imagine.
That.
You like this new franchise we've got going on here on the weekends?
I do.
Yeah, stock picking with Ozzy.
A lot of beeps in there.
You know, I think Chris Chan's position here in the weekend show, though, is still pretty well put down here for the E-Trade Investor Minute. And time now, actually, for this minute that we spend with Chris Chan. We're going to tackle a newly listed companies, rather, and trying to buy some of those issues. Of course, a lot of buzz can be surrounding some of these new IPOs and new companies that come to the market. But does that always mean that they're good investments? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Chris Chan will tell us more.
Initial public offerings, or IPOs, can generate a lot of excitement for investors. But financial planner Charles Fayle of Raymond James urges caution because trading in newly listed companies can be choppy.
Generally, the fresher trading the stock is, you know, if it's real close to the IPO date, there's going to be a lot more volatility, generally speaking, than the stock that's already been trading for, you know, a couple few years or, you know, even more.
While it may be exciting watching the swings in price in the first days, weeks, or even months after an IPO, he says it may not be the best move for conservative investors.
I don't really see the need, and I'm not sure if the risk-reward justifies getting into a volatile situation like that.
But Charles does feel that getting a hold of shares of an IPO before it's available to the general public can be a good investment if the company has good growth prospects. With the Investor Minute, I'm Chris Chan, E-Trade Financial.
We did have one big IPO hit the tape this week. It was a company called Regal Entertainment Group, and it's an interesting case here. It's an IPO of really what is now three formerly bankrupt companies that came together and formed the number one movie theater chain in the United States. And honestly, the rollout was pretty successful. It's still trading above its IPO price. John, from your perspective over at AppleTree Investments, do you like IPOs as an investment vehicle?
Absolutely, because the public market is the best way to get the original investors to get liquid, to have an exit strategy.
This is if you're able to get pre-IPO shares in a company is what you're talking
absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if it's a privately held firm prior to a liquidity event, whether it's sold to a strategic partner or whether it's IPO'd to the public markets, and typically companies sell between 15 and 25% of their company to the public markets, and then the founders get liquidity.
Right.
And that's why it's done.
And that's one of the final points that Chris made in his piece. If you do have an opportunity to buy into a company before it gets to an IPO stage, before there's a public spinoff, it can be very lucrative depending on the environment that we're in. Right now, though, the IPO market really isn't that hot. It's back open for business. It was closed for a long time right after September 11th.
Yep.
But let's face it, those companies that are coming to market right now are more mature companies.
They're solid.
They're right. It's not a business plan on a cocktail napkin like we've said many, many times before.
Yep. And those are the companies that are going public right now, and those companies have reasons to go public. They've passed the tests. They're mature companies, they have revenues, they have earnings, and they've passed the test to get public and to go IPO and to sell their shares to the public market.
Think about it from another client's perspective real quick, John. I mean, for somebody who wasn't able to get in pre-IPO, do you still like them immediately after they hit the public tape?
Again, that's political to get in, because a lot of times the underwriters, the investment banks that control the stock, they're going to give it to their special clients and the institutions that do a lot of business with them. So if you're in that category, God bless you, and you've done a wonderful job getting in there. But a lot of times you can't get in because it's oversubscribed, and so good luck getting in. But most of the companies that have the IPO pop, who've already invested, they're called angels or venture capitalists.
Well, we did see Regal Entertainment Group this week trade up to $21.45, up from its IPO price of $19 a share.
Wait, before we move on, guys.
Hey, what's up, Nanes?
We got another IPO coming up next week.
Which one is this?
Aeropostale.
Okay.
It's a clothing company. My colleague Amy tells me it's kind of like Abercrombie & Fitch, American Eagle Outfitters.
Do you guys have any of their clothing?
I've never heard of them before.
Certainly this area of the market, though, has been a successful one. If they've been able to battle against the gaps like Abercrombie & Fitch has, American Eagle Outfitter has, you know, if they're not selling the denims and the shirts and the khakis like the Gap has fallen into, it could be a successful one. Do we know when it's coming to market, Nina?
I think Wednesday.
On Wednesday? Do we have a ticker symbol yet?
Not yet.
Well, we'll certainly talk
about
it on the Wednesday and Thursday edition of the E-Trade Show that's on the Internet. Still to come on this weekend edition, Failing Finance, a new survey of high school kids and money.
Welcome back to E-Trade Financial Weekend with your host, WebFN News Anchor Tom Hudson.
Some surprising and perhaps disappointing news in education out this week that American students are failing finance. Just look at the results from an annual quiz of U.S. high school seniors out this week, finding that students are becoming dumber about the dollar, believe it or not. They're flunking basic finance. Now, earlier this week, Jonathan Honig and I were able to speak with the author of this study. Dr. Louis Mandel is a professor of finance and managerial economics at University at Buffalo. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Listen, this survey, it comes from an organization called the Jumpstart Coalition for Personal Financial Literacy. How do you define financial literacy, first of all?
It's sort of somewhat vaguely defined. I guess we were the first ones to get into it, so we kind of have the monopoly on defining it. But it's basically, we composed a little 31-question test of people's ability to make decisions in their own self-interest. Mm-hmm. It's not definitional. It's not academic. It puts people in age-appropriate situations and says, you know, what should you do right now? So financial literacy basically is a question of, do people know enough to stay out of trouble? Do they know enough to make decisions that are in their own best interest?
And why focus on high school seniors with this annual survey?
Number one, for logistical reasons, the only way you can sort of get enough people sitting down in a controlled test environment means they have to be kind of in school. And number two is, high school is the last time when we as a society have any real control over students and the kind of coursework that they take. As a former business school dean at two significant universities, I could say that we contributed nothing to the solution. In other words, we didn't even offer courses in this area. Either we get them while we still have some control over the curriculum, mm-hmm. or we release them into this sort of dog-eat-dog world and with really no protection.
So how are these high school seniors being released into the dog-eat-dog world, in your words?
Some of them go on and work and have to sign up for 401k plans and have no earthly idea how to allocate their portfolio for the longer run. Others go on to college, and the very first day of registration, first day of school and next September, they're going to run a gauntlet of tables of credit card companies hawking their 24% cards without really the ability to differentiate, except they give out premium incentives.
You get a free T-shirt, Professor.
Exactly.
Well,
yeah.
Professor, it's Jonathan Honig. That's what surprised me is that so many young people are seemingly very experienced when it comes to their money. I mean, a third already have a credit card. One of the statistics and elements of the study I thought were most interesting is that, according to the research, I guess students did better on questions relating to income than they did on questions relating to savings and investment. Why do you think that is?
I think partly it's because the average high school student now, even somebody college-bound, is working summers and part-time during the year trying to support that car. And
I guess the concept of retirement, Tom, is so far away or savings for a long-term goal. It seems pretty far away for a young person.
But also, Professor, do they recognize the impact of taxes, quite honestly, on that income?
The answer is that they do. They know what they're being taxed, but it's an unrealistic structure because, first of all, they're in a very low tax bracket. So at most, they're going to be paying 15% on some of the marginal income. Secondly, the takeouts from their pay, they by and large are on their parents' health policies, so they're going to decline any kind of health copay. Mm-hmm. Life insurance is not an issue. So by and large, they're going to get to keep almost all of what they earn, aside from Social Security and some limited amount of federal taxes. It sets them up with incorrect ideas. We ask a question, basically it says, Johnny earns $15,000 a year as a senior in college working part-time, and he has a job lined up for next year. Of course, it didn't really apply to the real world,
but right.
Tough to have a job lined up. But if you're lucky enough to have a job lined up, which pays $30,000, and what's going to happen to the total dollars he pays into federal income taxes? And only about a third of the students said that it would even double.
Wow.
Even though the students may know from economics courses that the tax system in the United States is progressive. Kids are very good at memorizing terms to regurgitate back on the exam, but when it comes to things that influence your behavior, so what is Johnny going to do? Johnny lines up that $30,000 job. Johnny goes out, buys himself a really nice new car, gets an apartment, buys some new clothes, maxes out his credit cards, all under the assumption that if he's taking home right now, 85% of his gross, then he'll still be taking home 85% of his gross, and boy, is he in for a surprise. He gets bumped up into the 28% marginal bracket, higher brackets for state and health insurance, and now there's a 401k.
There's a lot of ramen noodles in the menu for that kid, I'll tell you that.
Professor, it's Nina, the producer. Yep. My question is, why do you know, schools have all these courses set up for driver's ed, for health, you know, sex education. These are all very practical matters that public schools and private schools think are important to teach. Why do you think they don't have personal finance courses?
To tell you the truth, in talking to a lot of school superintendents, they believe that it's very important. And what they've told me is they don't offer it for two reasons. Number one, they're under severe pressure now to have their kids do well on these standardized exams. Mm-hmm. Their futures depend on it. And the exams are in a few areas, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. They're under pressure to whatever resources they have to put into teaching to those tests. That's number one. Number two is they've told me, quite frankly, that they just don't have any teachers or very, very few teachers who are knowledgeable about these things. You know, you folks on this show, you ought to be out there teaching this to the students because, you know, if you really look at it, who's assigned to teach this? So the state passes a law mandating that this be taught. So who do they give it to? They give it to the gym teacher. They may give it to a social studies teacher who, you know, who studied history in college. These are bright people who want to do well.
Right. No fault of the teachers alone. It's not their field of study. They don't have the training back up if they're mandated to teach these personal finance classes.
Right.
So there's plenty of blame to spread around here.
Well, I don't know that it's so much blame. I think it's recognition. I think it's slow recognition. And another thing, in a lot of schools that do offer courses, they offer it to the kids who are not college-bound. And that's one reason why on our national survey, the kids who've taken an entire semester do worse than those who haven't.
There's the irony. Dr. Louis Mandel, professor of finance and managerial economics at University at Buffalo. Still to come in the weekend edition, some final thoughts and an outlook for next week's market action. Stay close.
He's not coming. All he cares about is that car. Tell me about it.
Introducing the high-performance Lexus IS with chronograph-style instrumentation and Sinus Race-inspired cockpit.
Where's Sophie?
She's at home.
You're kidding me.
The news that he's not coming was such a disappointment to her.
Oh, please. She's so naive.
The IS also features Formula One-style shifting, so you never have to take your hands off the wheel to shift gears.
Sophie should never have gone out with him.
Well, no one should.
Well, I shouldn't have.
Oh, I don't know what I was thinking either.
The IS even offers perforated Exane trim seating so the driver doesn't slide during hard cornering. Under the hood, the 3-liter engine has an innovative tuned induction system to maximize torque while VVT-i optimizes power.
I wish this lobster would pinch him.
Yeah, on his nose.
It's him!
Hey, stranger, sit here.
No, next to me. I insist.
The Lexus IS. Totally unexpected. Test drive one at your Lexus dealer or visit Lexus.com.
Today's Wall Street Journal helps you succeed in more ways than ever. Subscribe now for just 38 cents a day. The Journal features all the important business news you need, and when it's time to focus on the business of life, there's the Personal Journal section. Get 8 weeks of the Journal for just 38 cents a day. This limited time offer is available to new subscribers in the continental U.S. only. Call 800-782-9500. That's 800-782-9500 for the Wall Street Journal.
The new E-Trade Financial here with some investment terms you might find helpful, like beta ratings for stocks and mutual funds.
Welcome to the new E-Trade Financial, with even more ways to make the most of your money, and not just through trading. E-Trade Financial has put together the comprehensive tools and services you need to build a financial plan, make investments, bank, borrow, and get advice. Times have changed, and so have we, by offering everything from banking and lending services to financial planning and advice tools, so you can get the edge you need.
A beta rating measures price volatility. Stocks and mutual funds have a beta rating that tells how they could perform relative to the overall market based on past performance. A beta greater than 1 could be more volatile. A beta between 0 and 1 shows potential for smaller price swings.
One thing's certain, E-Trade Financial has more of what you need to stay ahead in today's economy. So visit eTrade.com today or call 1-800-ETRADE1. Securities, products, and services offered through E-Trade Securities Incorporated, member NASD SIPC.
Take your business beyond the PC with EveryPath. Your business everywhere. EveryPath is helping companies operate in real time, offering complete mobile solutions. Access your company email, enterprise applications, intranets, and personal information managers anytime, anywhere. EveryPath mobile solutions can generate real ROI by reducing costs and improving productivity. Want to learn more about the benefits of mobility and how we can help your company? Call us at 800-2-EveryPath. That's 800-238-3797 or visit us at everypath.com. EveryPath, your business everywhere.
Welcome back to E-Trade Financial Weekend with WebFN News anchor Tom Hudson and John Vince.
Time now for another edition of Investing with Ozzy.
What is the f***ing Fibonacci theory? Sharon, what's the Fibonacci theory?
I'm telling you, man, I think we've got a new franchise here. I think Ozzy should get himself a weekend column at Barron's, maybe kind of an insider thing in the music industry for Business Week. Listen, that'll do it. We'll see if Ozzy will be back next week. I want to thank John Vince of AppleTree Investments for joining us this week. John, what should we keep our eye up for real quick next week?
Thanks, Tom. It's going to be a light economic calendar. Keep your eye on corporate earnings and margin recovery. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. John Hungle back in the saddle on Monday. Be sure to join us on the web. Two shows, The Trade, active investors invited along, no holds barred debate about the market between myself and Jonathan Honig. By the way, Jonathan usually loses those debates. It's at clearstation.com. Plus, make sure to check out all of our interviews and market coverage. Just point your mouse to mediacenter.etrade.com. Now, on Monday, you can hear the next part of our series, Financing and Education. Also, we'll talk to the author of The Phoenix Effect, 9 Revitalizing Strategies No Business Can Do Without. Remember, you can always catch all the interviews, plus a whole lot more, right there at the website, mediacenter.etrade.com. Have a great weekend, everybody, and happy Mother's Day. From our studios in Chicago, I'm WebFN News anchor Tom Hudson.
Before we go, our lawyers wanted us to tell you a few things about the show. The opinions expressed are those of our contributors and not necessarily those of E-Trade Group Incorporated. Please keep in mind that these opinions do not constitute investment advice or recommendations from E-Trade Securities or E-Trade Group. Not all investments or investment strategies are suitable for all customers. Before you transact, get the facts. Do your research before you make any investment decision. This has been a production of E-Trade Group Incorporated. Copyright 2002, all rights reserved.